What are those people thinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Michelle Jin, Program Coordinator for Student Physicians for Social Responsibility. She will discuss meetings and conversations she's had with students from around the world and give us tips on how to communicate nuclear radiation dangers to the millennial generation in order to attract their attention and get more people involved with our movement. We'll also receive our third lesson on social media super tricks, weekly quick tips on how to get the most out of your anti-nuclear online presence. All this with the irrepressible Dave Parrish of Operation Save the Earth. And there will be a serious update on the current spate of website problems which have been plaguing nuclearhotseat.com and which have now escalated. Plus our regular numbnuts of the week, activist shoutouts, and more nuclear information than has been mentioned by all 17 Republican presidential candidates combined. All of this coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 3rd, 2015, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. Starting out with this piece of good news from the U.S., the final version of President Obama's Clean Power Plan does not, repeat, not include aid to existing nuclear power plants at risk of closing because they can't compete with cheaper natural gas and renewables. That means that states will not be able to meet their clean energy goals, put that in quotes, by extending the licenses of existing nuclear power plants, which are definitely the opposite of clean. No incentives, guys. Why keep them going? In 2013, Morningstar identified 6 nuclear plants that could be next to shut down because of economic conditions. Indian Point in New York, Jinnah in New York, Fitzpatrick in New York, Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, Davis-Besse in Ohio, and Pilgrim in Massachusetts. In addition, Exelon has also identified 3 of its facilities in Illinois as being at risk. Those are Byron, Quad Cities, and Clinton. Exelon has been campaigning against tax credits for wind energy, boo hiss, because it can't compete. What's the matter, nuke dudes? It's a capitalist system. You can't make it in the marketplace. You are out. Of course, the nuclear industry is not sitting still and will undoubtedly bring to bear against this plan all the multi-million dollars it has in its PR machine and its legal vultures and its lobbyists and the congressional members it has in its pockets. And don't forget, Gina never met a nuke I didn't love and cover for McCarthy, head of the EPA, who has already said that EPA would reconsider the rules treatment of nuclear. That's you earning your money, Gina. And we're not talking about your EPA salary. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has launched a special inspection at Honeywell Metropolis Works in Illinois to assess a uranium hexafluoride leak that occurred during maintenance activities on Saturday, August 1st. The Metropolis, Illinois-based uranium conversion facility, located in far south Illinois, declared the alert, which is one of the NRC's 2 emergency classification levels for fuel facilities. Halfway to the top, guys. Keep going. You can do better. The NRC is seeking to verify the initial information provided by Honeywell, indicating that the material remained within the plant boundary. That's right. It came just up to the boundary and then stopped dead in its tracks. But this is not the first leak that has happened in the recent past at the Honeywell facility. On October 26th of 2014, just last year, the facility experienced another uranium hexafluoride leak. At that time, Honeywell, in its quote-unquote wisdom, did not believe that the incident warranted an emergency classification of alert and therefore didn't bother to notify the NRC at the time. Later, the NRC caught up with it and did change it to an alert, of course giving everybody plenty of time to respond to it as though it was a more dangerous situation than Honeywell was letting people know about. Way to go, nuke industry. You are so consistent. And as long as we're talking about our nuclear regulator, it's time for the Nuclear Hot Seat Duck and Cover Report. At Hope Creek Nuclear Generating Station in New Jersey, a 1-inch hole was found in the wall of the nuclear reactor's secondary containment building. What's worse is that it was likely made during the original construction of the facility,
which was 35 years ago.
That's right. It was most likely made during the original construction of the plant. The secondary containment building encloses the primary containment structure, which houses the actual nuclear reactor vessel, and is one of many safety design features required by federal regulations. The hole went through the entire concrete wall, which is 2 feet thick. Oops! For anyone who's making the case that new nuclear is going to be economic, just look at Vogtle in Georgia, where it's $65 billion and counting after 41 months of construction, and the project is still 39 months behind schedule. The astronomical over-budget of Vogtle 3 and 4 is completely in keeping with Georgia Power's record on the Vogtle site, where the first two reactors they constructed, that came online in the late 1980s, were a record 800% over budget. Just to give you a reality check, in the real world, nothing goes 800% over budget, and projects get canceled well before reaching that point. Unless it's a James Cameron movie. That's the only exception. Beyond Nuclear has filed multiple appeals in U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and one of these appeals is about a scandalous NRC rule change 8 years ago that effectively undermined the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, by redefining one word. They redefined the word construction to exclude excavation, road building, and the erection of some cooling towers. In this way, the NRC, those sneaky little devils, could reduce its oversight, meaning overseeing, not overlooking, without violating previous court orders. With only the reactor and its primary safety systems and structures included as construction in NRC reviews, pre-construction could begin right away on the property and structures around it without the preparation of a bothersome environmental impact statement as required by NEPA and affirmed by federal court rulings going back for more than 40 years. What a way to protect people and the environment, eh, NRC? And another reminder that we are still in the comment phase of the NRC's brain-dead, tone-deaf proposition that they replace the linear no-threshold model of radiation exposure with hormesis. No, hormesis is, if you believe that kind of garbage. Yes, the NRC has a proposition in front of it to make their policy that some radiation, low-dose radiation, is good for you. Comments are being allowed through September 8th. We will have a link up on the website. We should get the website up and working for your convenience in being able to respond to the NRC. And also links to some articles that will help you understand what to say, or just send the links to the NRC. They include a Stanford University report from 2005 and a recently created PDF by Dr. Ian Fairley, which goes into exactly what the impact of low radiation is on the human body. Both excellent resources. And that's this week's Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Duck, and Cover Report. As regards that last story, there's an excellent blog post up by Nuke Professional at nukeprofessional.blogspot.ca on how cancer rates started skyrocketing in 1945, which, of course, is when our atmospheric explosions of nuclear bombs began the current nuclear era. We'll have a link to that up on the website as well. The planned March 2016 reopening of the underground plutonium-contaminated nuclear waste dump, otherwise known as the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP, site in New Mexico, has been pushed back indefinitely because of unanticipated challenges, according to U.S. officials. Kel Surprise. Not. When this PR story was first announced by Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz on August 12, 2014, Nuclear Hot Seat number 164 called it for the bull rushes it was. A U.S. Department of Energy press release stated that the original target date of March 2016 for resuming waste emplacement operations is no longer viable due to a variety of unanticipated issues. Key challenges that remain include the need to resolve problems with the ventilation system, which is where plutonium and americium were released into the environment. Yeah, how are you going to get that out of the stacks? No replacement date has been offered. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
From the World Economic Forum comes this pro-nuclear puff piece. It asks the question, could we build nuclear power plants that float in the sea? Could we? Perhaps. Should we? Oh, no, 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 no. According to this article, press release propaganda manipulation, from MIT comes a novel nuclear power plant. Remember, a novel is fiction. A novel nuclear power plant that will float 8 or more miles out to sea and promises to be safer, cheaper, and easier to deploy than today's land-based plants. Promises. Remember the promises from the 1950s Atoms for Peace? Isn't that an oxymoron? Atoms for Peace program that energy created by nuclear reactors would be, quote-unquote, too cheap to meter? They love their promises. Goes on to say that the floating plant combines two well-established technologies, a nuclear reactor and a deep-sea oil platform. And how's that working for you, BP, down in the Gulf of Mexico? Among the quote-unquote benefits of this technology mentioned is that seawater can serve as an infinite source of cooling water in case of an emergency, with no pumping needed. Great. No pumping needed because it will be leaking the radioactivity directly into the ocean, raising the temperature, polluting with radiation, infecting the plankton, where from there it goes up the food chain, and continues to speed up the death of the Pacific Ocean, which is already taking place, or just spreads that little side effect to some other major body of water. Given what we know about the vulnerability of offshore oil platforms to storms, tsunamis, leaks, human error, all the rest of the problems that can happen, to say nothing of climate change and the rising of the oceans, why would anybody beyond, say, a master's degree program in theoretical nuclear engineering think that this was a good idea? No, 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 no. MIT, you got it. For this boneheaded idea, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
Over to Japan, where if you've got that sinking feeling, it could be Fukushima. That's because official report that buildings next to the Fukushima reactors have been sinking. In an internal International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, report, they stated, "We know that the buildings will decay and become less stable." They also said the impact of the salt on the corrosion of the structural materials has to be assessed and measures taken accordingly to retain integrity. KEPCO advisor Lake Barrett states that reactor building structure has likely been degraded and an aftershock may cause building failure. Other safety challenges during an aftershock may include containment degradation. And even the International Research Institute for Nuclear Decommissioning, or IRID, at their 2014 annual symposium, stated that they need to take into consideration long-term wall thinning by corrosion and the fact that stainless steel components may already be cracked. Hopefully there will be at least a little bit of justice, as three former executives of Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, will face mandatory indictment over the March 2011 nuclear accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. Unbelievably, nobody has yet been held criminally responsible for the world's worst nuclear accident. This decision leads to the mandatory indictment of the former TEPCO chairman and two former vice presidents for professional negligence resulting in death and injury. Quite the understatement. We'll see if this particular path towards justice does get a chance to play out. In the ongoing international food fight over the safety of Japanese foods, Taiwan has announced that those companies that falsified origin labels to bypass importation regulations on Japanese foods will be banned from future importation. They could also face fines for their law violations in the equivalent of $100,000. Hong Kong is currently one of the largest importers of Japanese food products, but at this rate, not for much longer. And Russia has partially lifted the ban on seafood from Japan's Fukushima area. A total of 23 fish processing companies in Aomori Prefecture will now be allowed to ship their products to Russia. But the trade embargo will remain for companies in seven other prefectures. The fact that Aomori Prefecture is relatively far from Fukushima played a role in that decision. In Ukraine, the western and eastern halves of the arch of the new safe containment at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant have been joined together. This nuclear matryoshka doll provides a sarcophagus over the Chernobyl sarcophagus, which has been breaking down, and completion of the project is scheduled for November of 2017, 31 years after the accident and only 1 year after the understanding that the containment structure would not be safe. We'll have our featured interview in just a little while, but first, a serious pitch, and this one is more serious than last week. As I record this, the Nuclear Hot Site website is down. Some of you can see the homepage, but you're not able to navigate to any of the episodes. On a different browser that I'm using, I don't see anything when I go to the site except computer gibberish. I don't know when I'll be able to upload the episode to the site, though if you're listening to this, some progress has obviously been made. Fortunately, the data for the site is intact and safe, so it can be reloaded when the problems get fixed. But we don't know how long this will be. This just underscores a need that I've expressed for the past 2 weeks, that problems, early indications, have been showing up, and it's now time to bite the proverbial bullet to get the website rebuilt and put into a Fort Knox-level containment vessel for safety. I am being helped in the short run by a good friend, a really good friend, who is taking time away from his business to talk with my website service provider, translate what they say to me, and then take the steps he's capable of taking. But even he admits that if he gets it back up and running, it's a chewing gum fix, not meant to stand up to whatever or whoever is causing these glitches. About 18 months ago, NuclearHotSeat.com got hacked and taken down for over 4 weeks. The warning signs of the last 2 weeks have now given way to this big honking mess. Rather than go for another piecemeal fix through Fiverr and Elance, I want to take this opportunity to increase the functionality, searchability, and look of the site, as well as make it safe. I found a reputable designer who is aligned with our movement, and I know he can be trusted to do the work. But in order to do so, I need your help. We need to raise about $2,000, maybe a little less than that. Now, I understand the difficulty, and no amount is too small to help in this quest. And I'm going to figure out some appropriate Kickstarter-like bonuses for all of you who step forward to help. And for those of you who donate $100 or more, I'll be happy to include a one-on-one consultation with me on any aspect of the nuclear issue you would like to discuss, including radiation awareness and safety and how to protect yourself. Or we could move it on to musical theater writing, book and ebook publishing, help with recovery from childhood sexual abuse issues, or if you like, I can write lyrics to a song for you. I'll do what it takes if you can help me move ahead and prevent these problems from stopping Nuclear Hot Seat from getting you the information you've come to rely on every week when it comes to anti-nuclear matters. Please do not wait. I need the help now. You can go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down the home page, and click on the big red donate button. And if you prefer not to do this online, you can email me or send me a message on Facebook for an address where you can snail mail your donation and whatever you can do to help. Know that it is deeply appreciated. Michelle Jin is the program coordinator for Student Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she works out of the national offices of PSR in Washington, D.C. Michelle is a recent graduate of the University of Minnesota with a master's degree in public health. She specializes in maternal and child health, and for her master's, she examined a wide range of studies dealing with the impact of radiation. She explains how she combines her educational background with her passion for nuclear issues and how to best communicate it so millennials will hear and want to get involved with us. Michelle Jin, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me here today.
My pleasure. You're someone who we recognize as being one of the younger adult members of this movement. You were born either long after the Cold War or just about the point that it was all winding down. So how did you first become aware of nuclear issues, and how old were you when this happened?
I first became much more involved with nuclear weapons and radiation in 2012 when I was 23. I had been working with Physicians for Social Responsibility for several years, and that path eventually took me down towards being nominated to represent the United States in an international peace bike tour in Japan that was all about nuclear weapons abolition.
That bike tour, which took place in 2012, was from Nagasaki to Hiroshima in Japan. What was that like for you, and what were some of the events and meetings that took place along the way?
That bike tour has to have been one of the changing points in my life that really has created a focus for me on something I'm truly passionate about and will be passionate about for the rest of my life. The bike tour, there were 40 of us from 20 different countries, such as Nepal, India, Japan, United States, Switzerland, Norway, Netherlands, Ecuador, Kenya, and other places around the world. And all of us are young health professionals in the organization International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, otherwise known as IPPNW. IPPNW was also awarded the 1984 Nobel Peace Prize. It was a two-week bike tour where we traveled from Nagasaki to Hiroshima, and along the way, we met with mayors in various towns, We met with local activists. We met with university students. And all of it was to learn from those in Japan and share our experiences of how nuclear weapons, from uranium mining to processing to waste, accidents, and the use of weapons have impacted us in our home countries, and to learn from those in Japan and their history.
What sort of reception did you get from the people? Were you welcomed in? Were there public meetings that took place? What was the experience like for you?
The experience really ranged from setting to setting. When we were meeting with mayors, it was definitely a very formal event. Media was also present. One of our meetings with local activists near a nuclear facility reactor was very casual, where we were all on the beach learning about these activists, what they were doing to try to prevent the reopening of a nuclear facility. But every event was unique and memorable.
This was in the immediate aftermath of Fukushima. It was approximately 1 year or a little more than 1 year after. How much did considerations about Fukushima factor into the journey that you took and the type of subjects that were raised for discussion?
Well, looking at a map, Nagasaki to Hiroshima, the bike path that we took was not near Fukushima. However, after the IPPNW World Congress that took place in Hiroshima, a delegation went to Fukushima to see more of what had happened for themselves, as well as to learn from those there. I, however, did not go because I'm still of reproductive age, and that would put my ability to reproduce at risk. However, other of our members did attend.
You raise a key issue, which is the impact that radiation has on women, on your reproductive system, on the fetus, and on children. And I understand that that is a key area of study for you.
Yes, it is. In the last year, I've been able to blend together my passions for maternal and child health and nuclear weapons and radiation. My work has been compiling research to look at maternal and child health outcomes associated with nuclear radiation exposure.
What was the nature of the study that you did? How did you gain the information? And what were some of the findings that you got?
I did not create my own study. I was doing a review, a literature review of studies from around the world, such as the KIC study from Germany, GeoCap study, and looking at just the scientific literature out there. Some of the challenges in the nuclear radiation field are that studies from around the world are not consistently done the same way. They're not consistently measuring the same outcomes. So that is one of the challenges, that they cannot be easily compared next to one another. Also, we have a problem with whose research are we able to trust. Some research, you have to really look at who is funding it. Is it truly the nuclear industry that's funding the research?
Please note that after the interview was concluded, Michelle requested that the specific names of the researchers involved in the study she now cites be eliminated. Out of respect, that has been done.
They investigate Three Mile Island. Funding for these two women came from the Three Mile Island Public Health Fund. However, who they were able to include in their study was limited. They were unable to attribute the increase in their studies to radiation exposure, because those who were in their studies could not have been exposed to a certain amount or greater.
That's insane.
Yes, it is. But that is one of the limitations, I'm guessing, of the funding. And learning about this, I only learned about this from one of my colleagues who's been in the nuclear industry for, 20 or 30 years. So as a new researcher, someone new to the field, there's still a lot to learn. And it's very challenging of how could I have ever known that beforehand without someone's age and wisdom telling me that insider information.
It has seemed to those of us who are perhaps not researchers that the information is intentionally confusing with rads and rems and millirems and doses and sieverts and all of the different kinds of measurements of nuclear. And now what you're telling me is that even the bases for studying the impact of nuclear on human bodies are similarly gamed at the source, meaning what the research money will allow for, but also beforehand, a priori, will discount.
Well, I want to make clear that I do not believe that the majority of research has been tainted. I think this is one example of a very few number of studies that have been influenced by the nuclear industry. But what it tells others is that we need to go to the root of it all. Who's doing the research? Who are they funded by? What is their stake in all of it? That is just a challenge, I think, for everyone to look into that, because that is a lot of research for the average person when we live in a world of one-click answers on Wikipedia. The nuclear industry is very well hidden. Laws are unclear, and they use that to their advantage. They being the nuclear industry. In general, also, one of the challenges to this is many people, especially in my generation, don't feel like nuclear weapons and radiation is a big topic. We feel like that's something from the time when we were just about being born or before that, during the Cold War.
That was one of the points that came in some of the materials that you shared with me, including writing that you had done. And I was taken by a quote from someone who was from Kazakhstan, and it came from a 2014 bike tour that you did for IPPNW. And what you wrote at the time was, "I found it interesting that almost every Kazakh person agrees that nuclear weapons are dangerous, but many do not feel that nuclear energy or uranium mining is dangerous or related to nuclear weapons." What do you do when you're faced with people who do not understand the connection?
The number of nuclear weapons that we have in the world is still in the thousands, and there's still some that are unaccounted for. All of these represent a risk. There is human error in the world. The technology that we are using to safeguard our nuclear weapons from accidentally going off or being deployed purposefully is not high tech. We are still using floppy disks. And when I say floppy disks, I mean the ones that literally wiggle.
And this would be some of what you would actually say to the young people you meet who don't understand what the dangers are.
Young people need to be concerned because the entire nuclear chain, whether for nuclear weapons or nuclear energy, is currently and continues to impact our health and the environment's health. From uranium mining, we're digging up materials that are far beneath the ground, and all those materials that are getting dug up with it are going into our water supply, our air supply. It's tainting water. Heavy metals are coming up. The land that's being mined can no longer be used for agriculture or to live in. Then after uranium mining comes the transportation. Particles are then flying through the air. Those particles might be passing by your elementary school, where children who are more susceptible to health problems are going to be exposed to higher amounts of radiation on small doses on a daily basis. Then come those who work in processing facilities. Then that uranium then goes into either weapons or energy. Just the exposure of low doses on a daily basis is drastically impacting one's health. There is a no threshold rate for it. It is shown that exposure is harming you. There's no linear line to it, but every amount of exposure is harmful. Then in this nuclear chain comes the waste that's produced from creating nuclear weapons or nuclear energy. This waste needs to be stored somewhere. We currently do not have good technology to contain it, so it does not seep into the soil or water supply. So as you can see, throughout the nuclear chain, from mining to transportation, processing, use, and waste, there is harm to human health and environmental health.
What kind of response do you get from people approximately your age when you attempt to tell them this information or have the opportunity to address them with this information?
Well, if I have usually about 4 minutes or more, I'm golden with talking to people about nuclear weapons and radiation to get them to understand a little bit more about the issue and to care about it. Less than that, it's still a struggle because the idea of nuclear weapons and radiation is still a grandiose idea far removed from everyone's everyday life. So when I do talk to people, I try to link it to something that's in their life, whether if they live near a nuclear facility related to perhaps Fukushima that had happened not too long ago, if they live maybe in the Utah-Nevada region of the United States, linking it to the downwinder population that was impacted by years of nuclear weapons testing. If someone lives near a waste site, talking about the regulations that have been changed to allow for more waste concentrated in a small area and what could happen if an accident were to happen. The hard thing is that these are all situations that kind of look at what if something were to happen versus what is happening. So when I talk about what is happening, I talk about the low dose of radiation that someone might be impacted by, especially if they are a parent. Talking about children really rings true with many people. People want to protect their children because children are young. They are innocent from having created these monstrosities of weapons or nuclear energy. Also, one of the things I find that motivates people is figuring out what can we do? Because I do feel like an educated person is aware that, yes, nuclear weapons are bad. They will kill many people, as seen in Nagasaki or Hiroshima. However, the United States will never give up their weapons. So why bother? Because nothing's ever going to change. So that's the mindset I find of a lot of people. But that's where the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons comes in. That's where the humanitarian pledge comes in that was put forth by Austria. That's where Physicians for Social Responsibility and International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War comes in. And many other organizations that work in collaboration across international borders for a world free of nuclear weapons and uranium mining.
So if someone is interested in becoming involved or at least being in a circumstance where they can learn more about this, what would you suggest? And again, I ask you to concentrate on the younger demographic, approximately the millennials, because for those of us who are graying within this movement or already have gotten to gray, we're really concerned about having new generations coming in to continue the fight for us.
If within the United States and you are a health professional student, either undergraduate, graduate student, I highly encourage you to consider attending the Student Physicians for Social Responsibility National Leadership Conference that will take place this September 19th in Washington, D.C. The conference is free to attend for all student PSR members, and to become a student PSR member, it is free. Just sign up on our website.
I love that strategy.
And the one-day conference is then followed by the Climate Health Summit. The Climate Health Summit is being put on by Physicians for Social Responsibility, Healthcare Without Harm, American Public Health Association, American Psychological Association, Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments, and several other organizations. This Climate Health Summit that will take place in D.C. will be a training on how to talk to your representatives about climate health. How it is impacting you and your community wherever you may live in the United States. And the following day, on September 21st, Monday, you, along with everyone else who is a part of the Climate Health Summit, will speak to their representative and talk about these issues. You will be trained to be lobbying and advocating for your issue.
Is this open to people who perhaps are not students to attend the Climate Health Summit?
So the Climate Health Summit is open to anyone and everyone who is interested in climate health while the Student PSR National Leadership Conference is for students in the health professional field.
Now, bringing this back to you, you recently got your master's degree in public health. Given that you are so passionate about this issue, what are you hoping to achieve in your career using your public health master's as a basis?
I intend to use my master's of public health and the credibility that comes with it to educate the public, to then create a space where the public, other stakeholders such as businesses, organizations, can work together to then influence our policymakers and inform them to create legislation, standards, and policies that will improve the health of people and the environment.
From your mouth to somebody in power's ears. And, of course, the hope is always that you will, by your passion and by your articulateness and by your master's degree, help to convince a whole new generation of activists to become part of this movement. Because let's face it, nuclear radiation and the problems it's created is going to last longer than the current generation of activists who have been at it for so long.
Yes, it will, which is the importance of getting many more young people involved. One of the best ways to do so, I found, has been seeing another person like yourself also involved. It took me years not to feel alone in this cause, not until I went to Japan and was face-to-face with 39 other activists from around the world who also care about this issue. I'm like, wow, I am a part of something greater. And that is what the conferences like PSR Student Conference in D.C. in September will do for people. It's what joining a student chapter of PSR could do for someone. Surrounding yourself with other activists and people who care about it enough to take action, to write letters to the editor, to call up their representative, to participate in a 350.org action, to participate in the Climate Health Summit. Being a part of this and surrounding yourself with those people is what's going to motivate this generation to get up and do something beyond read about it on their Twitter or Facebook feed.
I have no doubt but that you're going to be instrumental in helping to motivate that new generation of activists to come to the fore. We'll pass the baton to them and hopefully move this thing forward to some sanity and hopefully some resolution.
I hope so. That is definitely the goal I have. I want to inspire other people to get involved, to have a stake in it. I know the challenges that come with it. For me, it was meeting activists from around the world and meeting survivors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima to truly move me to take this issue on as part of my life's work. It does take a lot to move a person, but I believe being a part of large global actions such as the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, such as International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, are some of the gateways into being a part of this global movement for many years to come.
Michelle Jin, I can't tell you the joy that it brings me to know that you are one of those people who is going to be involved and will carry this into the future. On behalf of the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat, I want to thank you for being my guest on this week's show.
Thank you, Libby.
Michelle Jin is the program coordinator for Student Physicians for Social Responsibility. We'll have links to some of her blog posts about her PSR bike rides up on the website nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 115. Once again, we are happy to welcome back Dave Parrish of Operation Save the Earth. Dave hosts Fuku Friday Happy Hour Hangouts every Friday at 4:30 Eastern, 1:30 Pacific on Google+. For Nuclear Hot Seat, every week he provides those of us in the movement who are social media challenged with a solid tip on how to improve the way we use online platforms to grow our movement. Here's Dave Parrish with Nuclear Hot Seat Social Media Super Tricks number 3, Facebook.
Hey guys, it's Dave from Operation Save the Earth, and I'm back with the third installment of our social media super trick series. This week we're talking about probably the most controversial social media giant out there, Facebook. As we went over in part one, Facebook has over 700 million daily users, and according to Mark Zuckerberg, users spend about 40 minutes a day playing, surfing, and interacting with Facebook. As for myself, well, I run a Facebook page for Operation Save the Earth, am a member of over 60 Fukushima and anti-nuclear related groups, and spend about 3 hours a day or so on it. See, when the disaster began in 2011, Facebook seemed the perfect place to set up shop and start bringing all the voices together. But in 2012, Facebook became a publicly traded company and has been actively squeezing out our voices ever since. By going to a pay-to-play system and cranking down their algorithms, Facebook now only shows you about 2% of what you should be seeing on a daily basis. And although Facebook is moving towards a trending topics first approach, similar to Twitter, the company itself is far more fixated on making quarterly profits for their shareholders than delivering quality content, especially when it comes to Fukushima news. Ask anybody who runs a group or tries to post an E&E news link on their page sometime. Facebook just doesn't like us. But that's okay, because it's still a double-edged sword that we can use to our advantage. Recently, the mutated daisies from Fukushima Diary went viral on the web, and Facebook had the Fukushima nuclear disaster trending number one for 2 days. That's the first time that's ever happened. So Facebook can dial us down all they want, but they can't stop trends, and that's where this week's super trick comes in. Likes, shares, and especially comments are the very lifeblood of Facebook. Each affects their algorithm differently. Likes help you see more of what you want. Shares give you an opportunity to spread the word to your peeps. And comments, the most important of all, have a 48-hour shelf life to keep a topic alive and, best of all, trending. Don't focus on the going viral part, though, so much as the going vocal part. The more you can like, share, and comment on Fukushima Info, the more you're telling their algorithm to get with our program. Facebook may not like us, but their data spiders have to deal with us if we continue to force the issue. So if you're going to be on Facebook and you want to be active about Fukushima, join or start a group and get vocal. That's your super trick for the week. We'll see you next time.
That was Dave Parrish of Operation Save the Earth. To learn more about Dave's work against nukes, there is a link up on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 215. Activist shout-outs. Brava! Brava! Bravissima! To Mimi Gurman of No Nukes Northwest and Radcast for her involvement in the past week's Greenpeace bridge-dangling blockade of Shell Oil's Arctic drilling-bound icebreaker, Fenica. Gurman, who is one of the kayaktivists, was out on the river helping to turn the ship around despite the danger to her own safety. Now, Mimi's always been one to put herself on the line. Ovaries out. No room for compromise or retreat. And it's important that we in the anti-nuclear movement support other energy ecology movements when and as we can. To have her on the front lines with Greenpeace, posting her updates to those of us in the anti-nuclear movement, was a thrilling experience, like having a front row seat and being a direct participant. Well done, Mimi. You make us all proud, and you do us all proud. And mazel tov to online presence Sean Arklight, who has launched a podcast series on a wide range of environmental issues with a decidedly European and international perspective. You can find Sean and his posts on Facebook under S-E-A-N Arklight, A-R-C-L-I-G-H-T. And there's one more week to help nominate Nuclear Hot Seat for Best Podcast in L.A. Weekly, the arts and entertainment newspaper of Southern California. To nominate, go to laweekly.com and click on the banner at the top where it says Reader's Choice Awards, I'll also have a link up on the website. Now, some of you from out of the United States have tried to help me with this and complained back because you were not able to do so. Apparently, at some point, it asks you for a zip code, and it doesn't accept yours. I did call LA Weekly and explain the problem to them, and they said, look, we never planned to exclude people from outside the country. We just didn't think there would be anybody wanting to contact us from outside the country. Their automated system will not adapt to different kinds of zip codes. However, they didn't want to exclude you guys. So here's what you can do with their permission. You can go to LAWeekly.com, click on Reader's Choice, and at whatever point you are asked for a zip code, you can put in LA Weekly's zip code, which is 90230. And, of course, if you're already in California or any place else in the United States, just put in your regular zip code and you can nominate Nuclear Hot Seat. We've got until August 8th to do so, so please help. Here's today's final thought. August 6th marks the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the atom bomb on Hiroshima. And August 9th marks the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the atom bomb on Nagasaki. Two of the most horrific events of the 20th century. We now know that news about these two events was manipulated in the media starting from before their occurrence. Reporters and photographers were kept away or carefully managed to see only what the government wanted them to see. Their stories were not only vetted, but censored. And the New York Times science editor, William Lawrence, was so in the pocket of the government that he was given the nickname Atomic Bill. But the first Western reporter to get to Hiroshima published the only uncensored report of the aftermath of that horror. He was Australian journalist Wilfred Burchett. The following was discovered on JapanFocus.org and the blog of Richard Tanter. It's excerpted from Burchett's book, Shadows of Hiroshima, which was published in 1983, shortly before his death. Burchett's article was published on the first page of the Australian Daily Express. Actually, it was the first page of the Daily Express, and had the headline, 30th Day in Hiroshima. Those who escaped begin to die, victims of the atomic plague in big black capital letters. It went on as the headline, I write this as a warning to the world. Here's part of what Burchett wrote. In Hiroshima, 30 days after the first atomic bomb destroyed the city and shook the world, people are still dying mysteriously and horribly. People who were uninjured in the cataclysm, from an unknown something which I can only describe as the atomic plague. Hiroshima does not look like a bombed city. It looks as if a monster steamroller had passed over it and squashed it out of existence. I write these facts as dispassionately as I can, in the hope that they will act as a warning to the world. The police chief of Hiroshima welcomed me eagerly as the first Allied correspondent to reach the city. With the local manager of Domai, the leading Japanese news agency, he drove me through, or perhaps I should say, over the city. And he took me to hospitals where the victims of the bomb are still being treated. In these hospitals, I found people who, when the bomb fell, suffered absolutely no injuries, but now are dying from the uncanny after effects. The counted dead number 53,000. Another 30,000 are missing, which means certainly dead. In the day I have stayed in Hiroshima, and this is nearly a month after the bombing, 100 people have died from its effects. There were some of the 13,000 seriously injured by the explosion. They have been dying at a rate of 100 a day, and they will probably all die. Hundreds and hundreds of the dead were so badly burned in the terrific heat generated by the bomb that it was not even possible to tell whether they were men or women, old or young. Of thousands of others, nearer the center of the explosion, there was no trace. They vanished. The theory in Hiroshima is that the atomic heat was so great that they burned instantly to ashes, except that there were no ashes. The Daily Express not only ran the story to fill the entire front page, but it released this reporting free to the world's press. We are all still suffering from this atomic plague. If not the radiation from Hiroshima or Nagasaki, then from the bomb tests, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, Church Rock, releases from aging nuclear reactors, uranium mining tailings, manufacture, transport. Cancer, a known reaction to radiation exposure, used to be a rare disease. Now it's an epidemic, expected to show up in 1 in 3 men, 1 in 2 women, and the rates are only going to keep rising. So-called experts say they don't know what's causing this rise in cancer rates. But the one word they will never mention is radiation. The nuclear industry, of course, is doing whatever it can to confuse the radiation issue, making us believe that there is no long-lasting ongoing danger, despite the atomic plague reported from Hiroshima, and so much additional evidence. And now, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission wants to change the way of evaluating radiation exposure dangers to acceptable levels of radiation being healthy for you, a process known as hormesis. No, whore uses, if you believe that model and promulgate it. A link will be set up on the website, again, to tell the Nuclear Regulatory Commission what you think of this insane proposal, and comments can be made up until September 8th. To honor those who died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Hibakusha who survived with its awful legacy, those whose lives have been changed by the nuclear accidents, by the mining, manufacturing, and all the rest. Let's give the whore uses of the NRC a piece of our minds. And let us never forget and never ask, how bad can it get? Because in Hiroshima, in Nagasaki, they remember. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 3rd, 2015. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from ENEnews.com, Forbes.com, NJ.com, PowerMag.com, Stanford.edu, IanFairley.org, NukeProfessional.blogspot.ca, BusinessInsider.com, Reuters.com, LATimes.com, KTAR.com, Agenda.weforum.org, NHKWorld.com, FukuLeaks.org, SimplyInfo.org, PopSci.com, Enduke.org, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, TEPCO, the overpaid word pushers who write for World Nuclear News, and the heroic warriors of the Nuclear Hot Seat community on Facebook, which you are all invited to join. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weaver. Nuclear Hot Seat is syndicated by UCY.TV, and is also available on iTunes under podcasts. Our archive is available on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. We should only get it fixed so that it is available. Or you can still find it on iTunes. Our YouTube channel carries the show under Nuclear Hot Seat Videos, with our thanks to Joni Ray. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2015, Libby Halevy and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we have all had our nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but the activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat.